Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Change Your Mind podcast, where we explore personal development, spirituality, and science. I'm your host, Chris Ashley. I'm really excited for my guest today. We are going to talk about internal family systems, which is something I'm not super familiar with, but I have an incredible consciousness facilitator here with me to teach me all about it. First couple quick announcements. Head over to the links in the show notes. As always, you're going to find a lot there. You'll find ways to connect with my amazing guest, ways to connect with me on social media. You'll find links to my book, Change Your Mind to Change Your Reality. It was endorsed by three people from the film The Secret: Marcy Shimoff, Michael Beckwith, Bob Doyle. It's also endorsed by Anita Morjani, John Gray. So come check it out. Let's see what else. You'll find links to sponsor the podcast, free downloads, courses, coaching. And as always, this podcast is part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network. Sounds kind of weird that a Tribune, a newspaper, has a podcast network, but we have an amazing personal development branch with events pretty much every month, both virtual and in person, spearheaded by Tony Robbins, former EVP of production. So we have some huge names. I was just on stage with Les Brown, Dr. Joe Vitale, Jim Quick, Joseph McClendon, Mary Morrissey. So come join us, be a part of it. All the podcasts are amazing. What if the one thing keeping you stuck is the way you think? Welcome to Change Your Mind with Chris Ashley, the podcast where science meets spirituality and mindset becomes your most powerful tool for transformation. I'm Chris Ashley, author of Change Your Mind to Change Your Reality, trainer, speaker, and lifelong seeker. For years, I battled trauma, depression, anger, chronic illness, low self-worth, and the weight of old stories. Until I discovered how to rewire my mind, reconnect with my divine nature, and consciously create a new reality from the inside out. This show is here to help you do the same. Each week, we explore the intersection of personal development, spirituality, and science, diving into topics like healing, emotional mastery, entrepreneurship, resilience, and the quantum nature of reality. You'll hear powerful stories, gain practical tools, and real conversations that will help you change your perspective, get unshakable confidence, and live the vision your soul has always known is possible. Whether you're navigating a major life shift, building your dream business, or seeking deep healing and alignment, you're in the right place. So if you're ready to break through, take back your power, and create a life on your terms, this is your moment. Let's break free from the patterns that hold us back, awaken to who we truly are, and rise. Your transformation starts now. All right. So with me today, I have Dr. Diana Pack. Oh my gosh, how do I pronounce your last name? Did I do that right?
It's Pake, like cake. Makes it
okay.
Easy.
Okay, perfect. I like that. All right, so I have Dr. Diana Pake. So Dr. Diana trained in hypnotherapy, regression, and energy therapies at the HCH Institute in Lafayette, California. She holds certifications as a certified clinical hypnotherapist, Reiki master, several types of Reiki masters. I'm not going to even try to pronounce them because I'll mess them up. Certified regressionist, certified between lives between lives facilitator, and energy therapist. Dr. Pake holds a bachelor degree in history from Santa Clara University, a master of science in library science from the University of Southern California, and both a master and doctoral degree in public administration from the University of Southern California. She is also trained as a quantum consciousness facilitator and as an IFS, which is internal family systems, informed practitioner. She continues to do advanced training and holds certifications in weight management, virtual bonding procedures, past life regression, and other advanced energy techniques. So you are a wealth of information. Welcome, Diana. Can I call you Diana? Is that okay?
That's absolutely great. Okay.
I never know with the doctors. I don't want to insult anyone, so I like to ask. Because you've done so much study, right? Like you're obviously a truth seeker like I am, which I love.
Well, we start down traditional paths. You get traditional degrees, and that doesn't really get you to everything you want to know.
But so, don't you find that like everything you do kind of gives you some sort of skill set to take that next step, and then you end up like using a little piece of everything?
Yeah, I call them transferable skills. So yeah. We find that something is valuable. You're in a job, you're supervising people, you're working with people and mentoring them. And then that translates into something else somewhere along the line. And so we never really lose the opportunity to use what we've learned. It's just how do you apply it later on as you move on to something else?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I like that you got a degree in library science. The last person I talked to who has a degree in library science, you would love this guy, Jim Matlock on my other show. He takes people who remember, mostly kids who remember their past lives, and does a bunch of research and finds the people they used to be and their families and like tracks it down and verifies stuff. So just to me, it's like the mind of a researcher. Mm-hmm. So I love that. Okay, so I only come up with one question before my interviews, and it's the same question for everyone. And that's how I start my episodes. So I will ask you, what is your origin story? What put you on this trajectory that made you want to work with all these energy and healing modalities?
I think we all come into this life and make choices about where we are in our families. And we receive conditioning. We receive conditioning in our families, in our communities. We get understanding of cultural dynamics. And so as we grow up as children, we are conditioned to be like our parents or different than our parents, like our communities. And whether we like it or not, we get that conditioning. And then we have to face life. And I received conditioning from two alcoholics. So that was a starting point. And that, for me, posed some challenges because they were not great communicators. They were not great at expressing their own feelings. And so I learned to suppress feelings, to not communicate, to dissociate into behaviors that felt safe to me and kept me protected, but really weren't protecting me. And as I got older and older, I kept finding that what I thought was keeping me safe was actually harming me. So what really started me on this journey was trying to find out why I chose the ways of taking care of me that I did. When I was little, my grandmother died when I was six, and my mother was an only child. And when my grandmother died, my brother was 4 months old. My dad was working nights. My sister was a year older than me, and we live with my grandmother. And she was the person I was most attached to. And my mother basically went missing in action on us because she had a baby and she was trying to deal with everything. And, you know, when you're six, you don't understand parental dynamics. She was very bonded to her mother and lost her mother. And so here she's got two of us in grade school and a kid who she has to take care of because he's 4 months old, and we were on our own. So we filled in the blanks a lot, and we filled it in with food. And so both my sister and I ended up gaining lots of weight as young children. So weight became a lifelong issue for me of how do I deal with weight and weight loss, because society says you shouldn't be fat. It's not healthy to be fat, and you don't fit in. And so not fitting in became part of the story. And as I got older, as I tried to achieve things, tried to get jobs, being overweight was not something that was healthy or easy to find a good job if you're, you know, don't meet, you know, meet the model of what people expect. And so I kept working on me in different ways. And eventually I had weight loss surgery. I was 375 pounds. And had weight loss surgery, which got me to a point that I lost so much weight they had to reverse it because I was dying. And so then I had to learn to balance. So here I am in my mid-30s and having to change everything about my life to figure out how do I live now without the coping mechanism of food, And without what I learned about suppressing feelings, because now I'm feeling things and now I'm having to live my own life. And so I would say that was the impetus for really starting to try and figure out, how do I survive and how do I thrive? Because I think a lot of times we end up surviving and we keep doing the same things over and over again because it keeps us safe, but we aren't really thriving. We aren't living the life that we want to live. And how do you choose to do that? And I was working, I had good jobs, but I wanted to do more. I wanted to be more. And I wanted to love me in this body. And that is probably the biggest journey of this lifetime, is learning how to do that.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your vulnerability and for sharing all that. And I just have to call out, you know, I always, like I said, I ask guests the same thing every time. And I do that for a reason. And most people's stories are very parallel, right? They've gone through something tragic or traumatic, and they've overcome in some way, and now they're trying to help people. And I asked that question up front, not only to make people like relate to my guests more, but also to show listeners, like, if you're in the middle of that storm, there's a way out and there's resilience and there's people who have done it. But having said that, I have never had someone frame it in such an eloquent way as you did. And that's probably because of your work as a past life regression hypnotist. But I like how you framed it as just kind of looking at the bigger picture of like cultural conditioning and how we're here in this body and we get brought into this family and all of that plays a part. And then also just your empathy for the place that your mother was in as you were explaining that. And you know, again, that just speaks to how wise you are and how much you've learned along the journey. But I just wanted to call that out. So thank you.
I mean, when you're a kid, you don't have any of this awareness of anything, of what's unique about your family. And people who experience a lot of trauma may think that's just normal, how families operate. And so to you, it's part of your normal experience. But it may be totally bizarre to somebody else who has a much different way of being raised. And we begin to create ways of safety and protection for ourselves as a result.
Yeah.
And that's also a very normal thing. So when we get into trying to work with ourselves and resolve things, sometimes we're doing it out of desperation because we're in such a terrible place. And other times we're just really uncomfortable and life isn't the way we thought it would be or should be. And we're caught up in the stories that we tell ourselves about what life should be and how do we resolve that. So when I find people coming to work with me or to work, it's usually about being better, finding something better, more fulfilling. How can I live my life in a more comfortable, more fulfilling way? You know, I don't have somebody in my life. I'm not connected to anybody. I'm looking for a relationship. It's that there's not enough somewhere. And how they describe it is always different. You know, it could be something not enough about me or my environment or where I came from, putting it into whatever trauma existed and how they absorbed it. But the stories of being disabled about things in the past are a normal part of human experience, and that we have to learn to have compassion for ourselves and the journey that we've been on. Otherwise, we don't recognize the courage it's taken to get where we are and to begin talking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And just how far you've come as well. Right. Yeah. It's hard to see that unless you really step back and give yourself perspective. I want to comment on when you first started talking about this, you were saying that you thought that all families were like yours and maybe you didn't realize that there's a difference, but there's also like a flip side to that, that sometimes we feel like we're so isolated and it's only us. And then we come to find out like, oh, like you went through that too. Like for me, I was sexually abused and I went through all of these very cliche, like textbook behaviors that I thought, like self-harming or lashing out or doing drugs or whatever, that like, if you like open a psychology textbook for people with PTSD, it's like check, check, check. But like at the time, I thought I was like the only one. And then come to find out, it's like, oh, that's how psychology works. That's what happens. So it's, there's also that feeling of like isolation and then realizing like, oh, like there's other people that have gone through this.
But, and that's not, that's exactly what you don't recognize. Because yeah. Kid, your brain isn't there. It doesn't completely come whole until you're 28 to 30 years old. Right. So you don't have that rationality that you have as you're older. And a lot of times I think we feel no one is going to believe me if I say this. So there's the conditioning within the family that keeps everything silent and secret, the family secrets. We don't share things outside.
Oh, yeah.
And totally. And so that becomes something that you couldn't possibly share if there's something wrong. And we also think that's normal. It's like your experience becomes the normal experience for you, and you don't really have a sense of what other people's normal experiences are. It's just we don't have that capacity to know that or to sense that there's a lot of difference. So if this is how you're being treated in your family, chances are other people are being treated that way, but it's also a secret. You can't talk about it. So that's that secretness of we don't share. I remember my grandmother had a statement. It's very Victorian. And she said, you can do anything at home, but don't do it in the street and frighten the horses. So if you think about anything that you do inside your home, you can do in private. But if it's out there and other people find out, that you can upset people and upset things. And so you don't want to upset the world order, you know, or the town or the people around you. And we learn that. We learn that privacy. You know, we learn to put on faces of normal when in fact it isn't normal. And that's part of the conditioning that we experience, regardless of the experience. So people who don't have trauma, I expect that most people have some level of trauma. Now, you know, now that I work with people, it's just practically everybody has
pretty much everyone, yeah.
Pretty much everyone. And it varies, the flavor varies, how your experience varies, how you interpreted it and stored it varies. But almost everybody has some kind of trauma. And how did you deal with that? How did you internalize that? Did you have someone to talk to about it? This teaches you about whether it's safe to talk to anybody or not. And if you're brought up in an environment of secrecy, you can learn that it's not safe to share. And that if you go someplace and someone asks you about it, you go, I'm fine. There's nothing wrong here because it's not safe. And that's that kind of conditioning we all learn. And so when we start to work, it's like understanding what we were taught that isn't really us, but it's what we were taught and it was the norm our child selves learned. And that we can acknowledge that was the conditioning that we have as a starting point so that we're not judging ourselves for that conditioning.
You know, I've talked a lot about the conditioning that we go through as a child. I write about it in my own book, and I've had a lot of people on the show, but again, I don't mean to keep saying this, but again, I've never had anyone talk to that idea of like, we don't speak about this outside of the family, right? Like there's this secret and you know, if you talk about this with anyone, there'll be this sense of like shame and making them uncomfortable. And like, we don't do that because like, you know, we keep this in the family. And you totally just like brought back some stuff for me. I was like, wow, that was so how it was. And I forgot that, which is so interesting. So I'm glad you called that out. That's really, I mean, that's such a big part of, like you said, people's sense of safety and sense of connection.
And it's how we heal, is to acknowledge what is,
right,
that we store inside of ourselves. And as things come up, they generate feelings. So we have a feeling that goes along with that. So if a feeling came up with that, what part of you is storing that? Because there's a part of you that still is wounded from that.
Mm.
And not that it's wounded in a way that is causing you problems or harm or anything else at this point, but that there is a part of you that holds that emotionally and doesn't feel good about it, or feels shame, or feels something.
So that, I guess that brings us to, how do people access that part of themselves if they didn't even know they were holding on to it? How do they ultimately release that?
So what I find is that the journey of working with parts is to begin to identify that as a very normal part of us as we are growing, is that all of us have parts of us that hold things. And that your 5-year-old self who, you know, had her bike stolen and dad won't buy her another one is holding that wounding of not being trusted and dad not trusting you and now not giving you another bike because you're not trustable. So even though that may be a temporary thing, the wounding happened. And so that 5-year-old part of you is holding that wounding. Daddy doesn't trust me. He doesn't trust me with a bike. So how do you internalize that? So this is what we start with, is the stories and talking, just like we're talking about what happened. Where did something happen? How did you process that? We try and then begin to work with understanding the parts of ourselves who may be holding things. And there are some times within human development that seem to be pretty key for most people. So there are a couple of major times. One is in the womb and around birth and infancy, where the child is totally dependent on the mother. And as the child separates from the mother and begins to become individuated into him or herself, that's a point where distortion can happen. So a child may experience trauma if mom doesn't come and pick him up when he needs comforting. And he may internalize that in some way, and that can then cause some kind of response. So that infancy, early toddler seems to be a point where we have very little to go on, and we build on the context we have. So that seems to be one point. Another point that seems to be pretty common is about the time we go to grade school. So they call it the age of reason, this 5 to 7 years old. And during that time, you're realizing that you're a separate person from your parents and that you operate separately. And so you're learning about the world and you as a separate person who has some agency. And in doing that, you may then discover things that you don't like, or you may get punished for something, but you're different. You're not mom, you're not dad anymore, you're you. So that seems to be a point where learning can cause new behaviors and new ways of maintaining one's own safety. And the next point is puberty. Because at puberty, now you're coming into a time where all of these hormones are coming on board and you think you're adult, because your body is beginning to adultify itself and you're still a kid, but you don't think you are. Mm-hmm. And you're dealing with all the physiological stresses of moving into that through puberty and the social stresses of moving from being in grade school into high school and the socialization of all of these people who are trying to figure out who they are. And so that it's a time when you're trying to figure you out in relation to other people and can get very stressed and create meaning for yourself that then can cause you to seek safety in some way. So these are, for me, are places that are kind of common places to look. So when you're talking about this, you know, if something comes up and you're 6 years old, this is really a common place that's it's very normal for us to have these at these points in our lives. Doesn't mean we don't have them at other times, but for me, it's kind of easy to point those places out. And so we can start by investigating what happened to you when you were six? How was school for you? And just go through the story and try and figure out if there are ages of you or parts of you who were particularly wounded. So if we were to start with the age of you who experienced the sexual abuse, was that the first time you felt what you felt? Or was there a younger time that felt the same way? So we work from what you know and go back in the feelings back to earlier and earlier times that may have had no language but had the feeling. And we can see a lot of times that things that are very active when you are a teenager may have bubbled up when you were an infant and didn't know how to relate to parents, didn't know how to relate, ask for what you need because you didn't have language. And so that there are connections. So we start to see the connections of ages that are holding the same kind of emotional energy. So the first part is identifying. How do you identify the parts? And to have compassion for those parts. And one of the fundamental aspects of this work is that we have parts of us that are wounded, and we have parts of ourselves who are wounded who act like they're not wounded. So their safety is, I'm going to pretend to be a non-wounded adult, mm-hmm. and I'm just going to take on, I'm going to protect us all. And it could be a younger part of you who had to grow up and be the adult, and so acts as an adult, but still is a wounded part. So the first thing we have to do is to help you know what your true self feels like. What is the core of you? We have to start from the core of the true you, your true self with a capital S. So what does the true you feel like? The true you is the core of you in your most healed sense. And your wounded parts sometimes are called exiles because they're exiled from this core of the true self and are trying to be whole, be part of the true self, but don't know how to get there. So they're exiled. So we take you first into your true self so that you are aware that you have a true self, and we can ground you and help you see that this wounded part is not all of you. Most of you, in fact, is probably doing pretty well. And that you're here working on this wounded part is saying you have the courage within the true you to choose to heal and to choose to heal those parts of you that are hurting. And so we start from that point and begin to identify and then have compassion for the parts of you that are suffering and ask them what they need. All parts of us that are wounded have protector parts that try and keep them safe. So if I have a child part who is constantly being criticized, how do I protect that part? So I may become very quiet and not say anything so that no one will criticize what I say. Or I may become big and boisterous so I seem bigger and I seem more difficult to suppress, and then so people stay away from me and they don't question me. Those are both protective stances. And so each of us with our parts that are wounded then develop protector systems so that part of us is protected. And so if you are sexually abused, what's the initial protection? Against the abuser, probably, how do I keep the abuser from abusing me more? And then how do I keep myself protected outside? So these are levels of protection. And part of it may be to be very silent and not react so that you won't get hurt more. So someone who has a parent who is very much into physical punishment, I had a client whose father was into, he had three boys, was into punishing his boys by strapping, you know, hitting them with a belt. The oldest one learned that if he became useful and wrote out all the checks for Dad's bills, then he was useful to Dad as opposed to being a burden, and he didn't get whipped as much. So his protection was to become Dad's secretary. So he learned something that would keep him from getting hurt. The other boys got very quiet and tried to disappear. So we develop protections, and our protectors keep protecting us even as we're adults. They don't know that the adult you exists. So if a five-year-old you got hurt and developed a protection system, here's the five-year-old, and the protector says, I'm going to protect you and keep that from happening. And the protector only knows this five-year-old exists. Doesn't know that the adult you is even here, and to this day continues to protect this part. So when we're starting to work, we recognize that the protectors don't know that the adult and core you exists. And so we help them understand what their behavior is doing. We don't talk to the child part, we talk to the protector and say, tell me more about this protection, because we know you're keeping this part of you safe. How are you doing it? What does that do? What do you feel would happen if you didn't do this? And so we start working with the protector to understand the protection system, so the protector can see that there is more to you than this child part. And then there are different strategies for working with the protector and with the child part. So once you identify them, then and the protector begins to trust you that you're not going to hurt the child and you're not going to hurt them, then you can start to decide, how do we help you? Do we move the child out of the situation where they're being harmed? Is that something that is safe? Will the protector allow that? Or is the protector willing to change their strategy so that they can be a better protection, because the protection they're offering is hurting you now? Because they never want to hurt you. They want to keep you safe, but once they realize they're hurting you, it really is confusing to them. And so then we can work with the protectors to help them understand what it is that is happening, and then develop some solutions. So it may be the protector is willing to upgrade their skills and do something different. Or maybe the child part is willing to be moved to a completely different place where the abuse that was happening isn't happening now. And we start to reinforce that, and we invite the protector to go along also as a five-year-old part. And so then we monitor them over the course of a month and make sure that they're healing and that they are feeling safe, and the safety becomes a part of your physical body and you start to feel that healing. So it's not an overnight thing. It really is a process, not of just thinking it, but of actually embodying the shift in the healing process and having that part of you safe.
Thank you so much for all of that. And everything you said just really makes sense. And I like that you're not trying to like force the protector or the child to change in any kind of way, because I feel like kind of a lot of what you tend to hear out there is like, oh, we need to heal this, or we need to fix it, or just talking about it helps to release some repressed emotion or something. But I like that you're kind of like, to the protector, like, you're doing a job. Like, let's evaluate. Let's look at this person as they are now. Like, is this job still helping them? And like, and you're doing it in this really like kind of gentle, I don't want to say like manipulative, but like way that you're kind of, it's almost like talking to a child, right? Yeah. Like trying to like play with them a little bit, and shift their perspective. So then what does it look like when they're actually healing? Like what's the end goal here? And like, what does that healing process look like if things are just kind of like shifting in that way?
So let me use an example of a part of me that I've actually experienced. My child part, I talked about my grandmother and the food and eating. So this part of me became a binge eater. And so when I started working with this part, I knew that she was using food as an alternative for love. Mm. And that's what she was giving, and she just adopted that. And so when I started working with this, I knew what the protection system was, and I didn't know how to resolve it. And there were two choices. One, change the protection system, or move the child out of the environment where she was suffering. And she was so upset and so distressed, she didn't want to be there. And so she was very happy to move, and the protector moved with her. And so this part chose to be, she lives in Moorea, Polynesia. And so, you know, those hotels that are the huts that are out over the water, over the lagoon?
Yeah.
She has an end hut. It's right on the lagoon. And she loves being in this place. She is able to be her true, curious, athletic self. She can eat anything she chooses to eat. And food is for sustenance and for enjoyment and for learning. She loves the water. I mean, she's totally connected to the water and swimming and sailing and learning and being in an environment that stimulates all of her senses, and she can be curious and learn new things. She can have everything that she could possibly need. And her grandmother comes and visits, but this is her space where she is fully self-actualizing. So she moved to this place in July of 23. And since that time, I have not had a single binge eating episode.
Wow.
That behavior stopped because she didn't need to fill in the nurture that she wasn't getting because she was getting nurtured.
That's really amazing.
So I know. I mean, it's like, for me, I had to experience it to know what it felt like. And it wasn't, I mean, it has been a challenge to then recognize how the protector systems work, that what she was being suppressed. She was being held down. She was being held in to be the perfect child that my mother wasn't. My mother saw, she was believing that my mother was trying to turn her into a perfect projection of mother, which she wasn't, and personality-wise and everything was really different, and she couldn't conform to that. So when she was able to expand into the fullness of who she is and be that wild, athletic, you know, curious, smart, brave child, she had everything she wanted. You know, she's got connection. She's not very good at learning Tahitian. I wish she were. French is good. French is really good. Tahitian, not so much. Not her thing. But she is very engaged in that environment. And for me, that began the shift of, if I don't need to use food, if this part of me isn't using food and is learning to love herself, how do I feel in my body? Because this part of me loves herself and isn't needing to fill in missing blanks. And so the secret to the work, if you call it a secret, is you can't think it, you have to feel it. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a lot about what you find in Joe Dispenza's work too, is it's not something you can think, you have to embody it. So what happens within the body is that over time, as that part of me is feeling safe, those feelings of safety are within my body. And so as I check in with her on a feeling level over the course of a month, I'm developing new neural pathways for those energies within my body, so my body is becoming conditioned to the new physiological condition that she's experiencing. So the need to binge is no longer present, because the urge that came chemically that you have to put food into you is now no longer present. So it takes a while for those systems to develop, and during that time, you have to reinforce on a daily basis those connections so that you actually build those physiological pathways in your body, and that causes a shift in your physical makeup and what your body craves. My body craves to be active because she's energetic and active, as opposed to suppressed and shoving food in to keep herself dulled. So that really helped me understand why you needed to be persistent in going back to the story and back to where she is, because it isn't just thinking it, it is really then having that part embed into you as a living part of you who is now a part of your core self and is healed and is in, you know, living practices that are actually healthy practices for you.
That's so amazing. So when you're doing all this, when you're asking your wounded part what they need, and you're talking to the protector, and you're moving your wounded part to, you know, the overwater bungalow, is this all done under hypnosis? Are you in a meditative state? You said you have to keep visiting it. Like, what is that?
I'd say it's more a meditative state. So the first step is to ground yourself into your core self. And so when I'm working with clients, that's what I start with, is teaching you how to understand and feel your core self. If you can get there easily, great. If it takes you a little work, you have to learn how to do that, because you can't heal wounded parts if you're in a wounded part, because you don't know what healed is. You know, you're a wounded part is trying to help another wounded part, and they can confuse each other.
So when sorry to interrupt, I want to know more about the core self now too. Like when you're walking someone through that, what is that? I mean, and you obviously, like, you don't have to do it in real time, but just kind of give us an idea.
It's a meditation.
Okay.
So it's, and the recording I have of it is about 10 minutes, where you are recognizing that you are connected to the energy of the planet and the energy of the universe, and that each of us has running down us a soul line that is our core self, our true self, and it's always connected to the planet and the universe. And so when we recognize that, and it's an exercise you do with your breath, you're breathing that energy through you and feeling that infinite flow of the universe, and begin to ground into the core of you and know what it feels like in this body. So that body, you start to gain body memory of what your true self feels like. And it's always calm and always grounded. And you can feel that, and you begin to know that. And that's really fundamental, because if you don't know what the core you feels like, how do you know if you're in a wounded part or not?
Right. You have to have that baseline. Wow.
So we start with that. That's the basis. And then there are a lot of different techniques to use. There is a technique that is used a lot with children, not necessarily for this, that's called sand tray or sand play. And it's a box of a tray of sand, and then you have little figures that you put into the tray, and that helps tell the story so that it moves it out from inside, because children generally don't have the language skills, but they can show you in the tray. And so there are many times when I'm starting to work with someone and we start to identify parts, is we do a sand tray and try and see what the parts are and put them into the tray so they're outside of you. You're not trying to describe something, but you're beginning to get a picture in your own mind for what does this interchange inside of me look like? What are the dynamics that are going on? So drawing works. It's using something visual to help disentangle the wounded part so that you really can see it clearly. And that's part of the work too, is to disentangle. So I had to disentangle that child part for me so that I could see her and see the protection system as separate from me, so that we're not enmeshed, because it's hard to heal something that's enmeshed inside of you. So anything that can support that opening up of space so that you can communicate and you can talk to each other and you can build trust, which we have to do with protectors, helps, because then they can see and feel you and begin to develop the willingness to do something different.
I like that idea, because even if you're like trying to imagine it within you, I don't know, there's something about that where you're kind of embodying it again,
yeah,
in a way, right? Like, I don't know, you compared it to Joe Dispenza, and now I just keep thinking about his work. But if you're really like focusing on that inside, it's almost like you're reliving that, and it's not doing what you're hoping to do.
Right.
So I like that idea of putting it outside.
And it gives you a visual reference. Mm. So today I was working with somebody and she was talking about the warrior within her. And we'd done a sand tray a while ago. And so she literally had a figure of a warrior. And so she was going back to that. She has a visual now. And those visuals can be really helpful because they ground you into something that is, that you can see isn't the whole of you. And where the hope comes in is you realize this is a wounded part of me, but it isn't all of me.
Yeah.
Not all of, you know, when you're in a space where you're binge eating and you can't get out of that cycle, how do you get some hope that there's hope that you at some point in your life will not be a binge eater? And I had to learn that was a part of me. It wasn't all of me. And once I learned that and could identify that, it's like, oh, such relief. It isn't all of me. There are parts of me that are really strong and that are part of the core, and that I've developed more core strength, you know. And so being able to, for me, having that visual reference has been very helpful working with adults, because they don't know what those parts look like and they don't know the story. And then when we're working with the parts, they can tell the story in the sand tray instead of trying to, they can tell it in the pictures of the figures instead of trying to put into words things that they don't have words for. And if you're dealing with things that come from infancy and before you're born, there is no language. So you're having to show that. So if you have baby trauma, how do you get to the baby trauma where there's no language? You know, it's like you have to use a symbol of some kind. And language is simply a symbol, as are, you know, a little baby that you can hold in your hand and feel compassion for, because it's a symbol of you.
When you're working with someone, how many wounded parts on average do people end up finding?
I think there are more wounded parts than we could ever find. If you think about the seconds in the day,
yeah,
of every day of every year of your life, you have the potential for having a wounded part in every second of every day.
Right.
Not that we do, but we generally find the big ones, the ones that are causing us harm, are causing us sadness, are causing us separation, where we have safety mechanisms that are problematic in our lives. And we tend to focus on those because you get a few of the big ones and your life is so much better. Do you need to work on the other ones? Maybe you have ones that only come up once in a while. I have a part that, because I had to have transfusions when I was 5, because I hemorrhaged after having my tonsils out. They put my arm and tied it to a board so that they could put the needle in my arm. Well, I'm 5 years old. And so you bring an IV needle next to me, I literally climb the walls. So this is a traumatized part. I haven't done work on it. The only time it bothers me is when I have to have an IV put in my arm.
Right.
And then it really gets traumatized. But yeah. It's like one of those that doesn't come up any other time because it's very situational. So I think all of us have those situational things that occasionally we notice and go, oh, I should work on that in my abundant spare time. And then there are other ones that really drive us nuts, and they're the ones we focus on.
Right, the ones that are really dictating your life. Okay, so as a mother of a 14-month-old, I have to ask, for the early toddler infant one, do you find like, okay, let's say it's they're crying and the mom doesn't pick them up. Is this like a repeated thing that traumatizes people, or if it happens like a couple times, did I?
Yeah. Okay. It's that there.
So much pressure raising a human.
Exactly. And it's more the sense that you're unloved, that you're not receiving the nurture that you need. So usually it's like you're hungry when you wake up, you're hungry, you're wet, you think you're going to die, you know? And as you begin to learn that mom shows up not at 2 o'clock, but she shows up at 3 o'clock or 2:30 to feed you, then you begin to adjust because you get the nurture and you're nurtured. So it's a reinforcement of the nurture that then helps you move through and realize that your system is working a little faster than mom's. And if you just lie here and relax, everything is fine. So you begin to develop a context that you're not being left to die, but that your, body clock is working a little differently than mom's. And so you develop a way of a coping mechanism for yourself. And so what's important is the nurture bond and how the nurture bond continues even as the individuation happens between mom and baby, where the baby is gradually learning that they're separate from mom and they're not mom because they were and now they're not, and that in that bond that they are still nurtured and that the love and nurture is still there and that they are being supported in being separate and being their separate selves and becoming who they actually are. And this is where a lot of the wounding happens when you have parents who are overwhelmed and they can't deal with the kids and, they aren't paying attention. And very early wounding comes out of very wounded parents.
Okay, so I didn't like mess my kid up too much if he cried a few times and I wasn't like there immediately.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's when it's something that leads to greater feelings of abandonment.
Got it.
Aww. So,
and then like you're like, oh, I don't want any baby to feel that.
No, of course not. And babies have to learn, the challenge with babies is they have such little context. They don't know anything about the world and they have very small means. Their brains are not developed enough to have any kind of cognitive awareness. And so they're just really trying to figure out how to stay alive.
Right. Wow, this has been such an enlightening conversation. I can't believe almost an hour has flown by. I know you have a client after this, so I want to respect your time. But I'm sure people want to connect with you. They want to find out more. Take a moment and let people know where they can find you if you conduct these sessions over Zoom ever, like your website, all the things.
Yeah, so I work both in person and online. I do a lot of Zoom work. And I'm always available for consultation. So if people are wanting to work on something, I'm happy to schedule a free Zoom consultation with people. And they can contact me through my website. One is dpconsultingservices.biz. dpconsulting.biz. I don't know my own website. My other website is called sfbayregressions.com. And that's my one that faces towards past life regression work. But my general website, DP Consulting Services, is dpconsulting.biz. And if you just look up my name, There aren't very many people with this name, and you will probably find me because I do pop up on the web and I am on Yelp. And so if people just type in my name, they're apt to find me and find my website. And I'm always happy to respond to text. I'm not very good with voicemail, but text is really good. So I'm happy to answer questions if people are trying to figure out where they start. And my feelings aren't hurt if you decide to work with somebody else, and that may be something I may suggest depending on the work you're doing. You may want to work on Zoom, and I may feel it's better for you to work in person closer to you. So it's an open conversation, so don't feel stymied if you don't feel comfortable making an appointment. I'm still happy to share information.
Wonderful. And if for anyone that's like, ooh, past life regression work, Diana and I are going to have another conversation on my other show, which is on newrealitytv.com. I almost said .net, .com. So that'll be up pretty soon. That'll air before this one. And then, you know, we didn't put a name to this work. I've heard it called parts work, but is there something else that you call it just so people have context?
It's called IFS, or Internal Family Systems. Okay. And it is parts work. I mean, obviously we're talking about parts. And it came out of the idea that in a family, and when your therapist is working with a family, there's always a member of the family who's the sick one. You know, if a family has issues, there's a sick one. And so the person, his name is Dick Schwartz. Family therapist, and he began to see if this is a system that's going on within a family, does that also apply within each of us as an individual? Do we have parts of us that are healthy parts, connected parts, and wounded parts or exiled parts? And so when he started to apply that model inside of an individual, he found that, yes, that makes a lot of sense. And so the protocols around this have grown up over the past 35, 40 years. And Dick has written several books on internal family systems, and they're all very readable, and he speaks a lot of conferences. So it's an interesting protocol to use. I've been trained in it. I haven't done extensive training, but it fits within my view of the world and how I work with people. And so I use it with practically all my clients.
Amazing. Thank you so much for explaining all that. Thank you so much for coming today. I could have listened to you talk for hours, so I appreciate you. You're such a wealth of knowledge. If you're listening to this, send it to someone you think might resonate with it. Like, comment, share, subscribe, all the things. Have a beautiful rest of your day.